One of the funny things about religion is it's something that people in the Western world never seem to really learn, except for very few people who are the genuine mystics. Something that people in the Western world never really learned. But if you take any aspect of religion and start thinking on it very much, it kind of dissolves like a lump of sugar in water. You know, all of a sudden there's like nothing there. Things don't actually fit together in a way that makes sense if you try to overthink any aspect of it. That's even true for such amazing Buddhist teachings as dependent origination, which, you know, there's this huge volume of analytical work on dependent origination, which was done centuries and centuries ago, and it's probably still being done by some poor fool or other. And, you know, no teaching, no religious teaching can bear that much intellectual work. You end up with a lot of clarity about nothing at best. And at worst, you end up with just a lot of confusion about nothing. But in either case, it just doesn't do you any good. Dogen goes so far as to say that you don't need to know anything about teaching such as dependent origination. Which is funny coming from someone like him who is so brilliant and knew so much about Buddhism. But in actual fact, what he was thinking of, I'm sure, was the over-intellection about it. He also says at another point in Shobo Genzo, he says that I don't know exactly how to put it, but he speaks in a very derogatory way about the five ranks, which is, you know, an amazing teaching. But again, he's talking about the way people turned it into an intellectual game and tried to make sense of things intellectually. The thing is that these teachings don't originate in an intellectual effort. They originate in people's experience. And then in order to help other people come to the same experience, people put the teaching into words. So I'm going to talk today about some things that if one were to try to work them out too much in thought, they just come unglued. And things that work go very well together if you try to intellectually jam them together and completely harmonize them conceptually, it won't work. You just hit paradox after paradox. And yet at the same time, Buddhism has this amazing wealth of teachings, and in particular, Soto Zen tradition, as passed on to us by River Master, has an amazing wealth of teaching that is enormously helpful. So it would be as wrong to say that one must not ever think about the teaching or study the teaching as it is to overdo it intellectually and try to penetrate intellectually what cannot be penetrated intellectually. You see, there's a middle path, as in all things. There's a middle path that one needs to walk. River Master told me privately, not long before she died, she said, in order to have the highest realization, you have to have both the highest practice and the highest teaching. And that has remained like imprinted in my mind and in my heart since she told it to me. I don't know if she told this to anyone else, but she told it to me privately. And I think it's true. I think if you don't have the highest teaching that goes with the highest practice, people easily get confused about things that, with the right teaching, they can click on. And it's, you know, the responsibility of priests or teachers to try to give the highest teaching insofar as they're able, given whoever it is that they're teaching. So please understand that I'm not advocating some kind of dodge for people who are just intellectually lazy or afraid to teach, to give teaching, and who want to fall back on some formula that, well, this is Zen, and, you know, just you have to experience it, and I'm not going to explain anything to you. I don't buy that any more than I buy the other extreme, that you can grasp it all intellectually. You can't do that either. We're into doing the possible and the finest job we can with the possible. So the first thing I want to say about today, and one of the lines I was going to talk about, is about the confusion that we so often run into with regard to the Buddha nature. River Master used to say, and it really is true, you have to have faith in Buddha nature. You have to have faith in your own Buddha nature. You have to have faith in the power of the Buddha nature, the power of the eternal to help you. You know, I talk so much about asking for help, as Rim Master did, and without a clear understanding that there is that which helps, what the hell is the point? It's not just some kind of mindless exercise. You formulaically ask for help. There is that which we ask for help. And it's very good at hearing. It's got perfect hearing. And every sincere asking for help evokes a response from that deep place. In the Western world, people have got themselves all wrapped up in knots over what God is or isn't. And the problem all comes from a couple simple difficulties. First of all, is that they're trying to deal with the concept of a historical God, a God that is a creator and that has a certain role in human history. And by Buddhist point of view, that's a very kind of primitive view of things. The second thing is that the concept of God is a God that is, as a medieval theologian said, transcendent rather than immanent. And that means a God that is external to us, is viewed as a being separate from us. And when you combine those two, it's a rather toxic spiritual combination. And there's a good reason why people in the West, especially more educated people, are troubled by this idea of what God is. At the same time, that some of them who you'd think would know better persistently stick to it that that's what God has to be, or there is no God, you see. Which is a classic way to view the opposites. There is or isn't defined in this way. Well, from a Buddhist point of view, you'd say, well, whether there is or isn't defined in that way, that's not what the Buddha nature is. You see? In Buddhism, if there are kind of super beings who, or one or more super beings who are a creator and who have a role in human history, that's fine. That's not the Buddha nature. That's just a bigger version of us. And like us, it needs to be trained. It needs training. And it's always been the Buddhist view. Buddhism just said, well, if the gods exist, that's fine, and the gods need precepts too. But that's not what the eternal is. That's not what I mean by the eternal. It's not what the Western Christian mystics mean by God. At least it's not all that they mean by God. Because there is this other stream, this much more quiet, much less widely known stream in Western religion, which emphasizes the immanence of God, that God manifesting in creation, creation as the external appearance of God, God not being separate. And in Christian doctrine, that is the idea of the Holy Spirit is much closer to that, you see, than God the Creator. That's probably why they came up with a triune notion of God, because it didn't seem right to leave out the immanence of God. But you can actually throw out the others and just stick with the immanence of God. And if that's what you stick with, then you're fine. So long as you remember that no external form and no external expression defines what that is. So in Buddhism, we have Buddha nature, the eternal, the cosmic Buddha, whatever you want to call it, however you want to call it, doesn't matter, the heart with a capital H, the bodhicitta, the heart of enlightenment, the shin. Now, there's so many different ways it's expressed in Buddhism. And so when Westerners get their hands on that and apply the intellect to it, what they work out with that is that this is kind of like an abstract principle. To some extent or other, you may be able to have faith in it, be able to put faith in it. But it is not like a person, like this other idea, like a big person. So that means it doesn't have the attributes of personality, which includes intelligence and will and that kind of thing. And here's where they step over a line. No right-thinking person in Buddhism ever said that the Buddha nature is not intelligent. It's wisdom personified. It's the perfection of wisdom. Just as the perfection of love, compassion. So again, I'm trying to describe the way that this essential teaching gets mangled when you bring the intellect and your past history, kind of cultural history, to it. And that's what we must not do. With a sincere and naive mind and heart, you can always turn towards the Buddha nature. You can always ask for help. You can always turn towards the Buddha nature, and you can always listen for that guidance that comes from the Buddha nature. With a childlike faith, without all the concepts and inhibitions and restrictions that we ourselves try to place on that which is infinite and which is beyond intellection. With a childlike faith, you can always turn towards the Buddha nature. And every sincere prayer is heard and responded to. And you can take that to the bank. There are more adult ways and less adult ways of doing that asking and that listening. If you have come to a point in your spiritual life where you are capable of the more adult ways, then you need to do it in the more adult ways. I'm speaking of spiritual adulthood, not in the more childish ways. The more childish ways to turn towards the eternal and ask for help is to ask for some specific thing you have in mind. And Rinpoche Master used to say, be careful what you wish for. And that's really true. That can boomerang on you big time. Be careful what we need to be careful what we wish for. The more adult way to ask for help from the eternal is to just ask for help and to leave it to the eternal, the form in which the help will come, to not put any conditions on it. The way I do that is when I'm faced with a situation that puzzles me, I know I can simply ask for help and meditate with it. And I know that I don't have to put any conditions on it. All I have to do is just trust. The message got sent, the message getting processed, sit still. And it really doesn't matter whether it actually is the case that in fact the help is always there and when I ask for help I just open myself to it, or whether in fact my asking for help somehow stimulates the help to pour out. It's probably both and neither and something beyond all that. It doesn't matter. All that matters is that I know I can do this. I know I can trust it completely. And I know that I have my role in it that I have to do responsibly. I still have to meditate. I still have to open my heart and make the offering, not cling to any one-sided understanding or one-sided demanding, cling to any form of demanding or insistence upon how the help shall come, when the help shall come, what will be the vehicle to help, etc., etc., etc. Leave that to the eternal. And just ask. I've often, in talks I've done, mentioned D.T. Suzuki's commentary on the Lankavatara Sutra, where he talks about the intelligence of the Buddha nature. And he points out just what I've been saying here, is that people can think that it's just an abstract concept. It's not. It's infinite intelligence, infinite wisdom. And it's not some kind of passive principle that kind of set things in motion and then does nothing. It's infinitely present and infinitely alive and infinitely available. As our refuge. You know, I've been talking in this series of talks about the problem of erudition, the problem of insisting on intellectual clarity and trying to have it when in fact we don't need it. If one really knows the eternal's got it covered in terms of intelligence, then we don't have to really be all that bright. We don't have to have it all figured out. What we need to do is be good askers, good offerers, and good listeners, and good waiters, and good followers. And the truth of the matter is that very simple people, uneducated, not intellectual at all, have penetrated the deepest place spiritually, had the highest realization. And this has been going on for many centuries. And no one ever did it without deep faith. It's the deep faith we need, not being Mr. Smarty Pants. Or Miss Smarty Pants. Ms. Smarty Pants. Now, the next thing I want to talk about a little bit is just the way of law of karma functions in relationship to Buddha nature. And mostly what I want to say about that is, if you try to figure that one out, you can give yourself a big headache. You don't need to figure that one out. The functioning of the law of karma, of which the teaching of dependent origination is just a reasonably thorough explanation. The functioning of the law of karma is the most amazing pragmatic and also amazingly complex working out within the actual lives of living beings of the implications of their actions, by which I mean to say that it is in the consequences of our actions that we see what those actions really meant, regardless of how we conceived of it at the time. And since this takes place not only within one lifetime, but over a number of lifetimes through a whole stream of karma, the complexity is really beyond our capacity to grasp. We're given just enough insight into it to be able to get on with certain things and be able to learn certain lessons that we really need to learn. More insight is not needed, and one certainly doesn't have to go through a whole bunch of intellectual rigmarole about it. To my own satisfaction, I've come to see the working out of karma as an expression of cosmic compassion. However painful and difficult certain phases of that working out may be, and some of them can be very, very painful and very difficult. Some particular lives can be a manifestation of simple karmic consequence in which a great deal of suffering happens in a relatively short time in order to, as it were, clear the books so that deeper spirituality can then be penetrated. It may have to happen in another life. So some beings are born into a situation involving just one darn misery after another, from birth till death. And yet, however we may perceive things, the fact is that no death is an ending in the way that we tend to think of endings. And there is a cosmic compassion and a cosmic education happening through lifetimes, and a cosmic spiritual opportunity being offered passing through lifetimes that is more than any one of us can comprehend, even with regard to our own stream of karma, much less to the infinite numbers of streams of karma all interweaving together in this universe. And yet, I know this from my own experience and from insight that was given very directly in my retreat 98-99, that there is no aspect of this incomprehensibly complex working out of karma that is not an expression of compassion. And there is no aspect of it that is apart from the eternal. And you could really drive yourself nuts trying to figure that one out. As I say, it was given as a direct insight without the necessity of thinking. But I can't begin to comprehend it. There's no way. And if I try to, I'm just, going to give myself a big headache. Some things we have to accept on faith until such time as we're allowed to see something. And then after that seeing, we still have to just accept that's enough. I am not God. It isn't necessary for me to know the mind of the eternal and the workings of the eternal in their infinite complexity. It is enough for me to know the eternal is. It is enough for me to experience the love of the eternal. That is possible. It's enough for me to know that that infinite intelligence and infinite wisdom is always there and that none of us is ever apart from it, even for an instant. It is enough to know that. It is enough to trust that, because the fact that one has seen it once doesn't mean one doesn't have to keep trusting it. So here's one of the practical readouts of what I'm talking about. You can't do this practice successfully, what we're doing, without the faith in these things. That this practice that we're doing is for people who have faith in these things. Faith in Buddha nature, faith in the working of the law of karma. Is this deep meditation practice is going to bring you to the point where there is weakness in faith, it's going to get exposed. It's really going to get exposed. And if one's going to keep going deeper, one's going to have to choose the root of faith rather than the root of intellection and the root of doubt. This is necessary so that the actual conversion of those karmic jangles can happen, so that the actual spiritual need for our anguish and our confusion that we carry in us can be met, so that the help can penetrate to those parts of ourselves and of our karmic inheritance that most need that help. no matter how far we go in training, there's always going to be something we're facing that challenges us in this area of faith, that challenges us to trust. That's as true for me as it is for any of you. It was as true for Reverend Master as it is for any of us. There's always going to be something that we're facing that challenges us to trust. And the worst thing we can do is become little know-it-alls after a certain amount of training. We think, well, I've been doing this so long and I've reached a certain point, and this somehow, you know, what should happen when you've been doing it this long and you've reached a certain point in others' recognition of you and the like, there's, you know, what should go with that is a certain amount of know-it-allism, you know. And it doesn't really work that way. What really should go with that is a certain amount of humility and the knowledge of how much one needs to trust. The knowledge of how little one really needs to know about anything. The single phrase that Reverend Master seemed to say most often in 1976 and 1977 when Ms. Kensho was taking place, I remember two phrases she said over and over again. One was, "Is enough for me to know the Lord of the house." She said this again and again. "Is enough for me to know the Lord of the house." The other one was, "Just long for the Lord of the house. Just long for the Lord of the house." Do not think that you need to be accumulating some kind of knowledge here, some kind of competency. Because whatever it is that you're accumulating, I promise you, it's going to be taken away from you. And if you're clinging to it, that taking away is going to be scary as hell, and it's going to be very painful. What we're trying to do is we're trying to learn to live with empty hands or a full heart. To know where our refuge is and to go there again and again. And to find again and again that that is enough. And that out of the infinite love of the eternal, we are actually given what we need. It looks after us. And the more we look to it with a childlike faith, the more we see how we're looked after. And the more our faith is strengthened. Her master had said, sometimes, you know, it seems like we're doing all the trudging, all the work, and then one day we kind of realize, well, we were being carried. We were being carried. We didn't know it.